我是杨安子，我在竞选美国总统。I'm Andrew Yang. I'm running for President of the United States in 2020.
The road to the White House starts here at VOA Asia. It's Tuesday, February 19th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, President Trump may extend the trade tariff deadline, gathering aid for Rohingya, saving fossils that already survived millennia, disappearing insects, cars in Chicago. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Andrew Yang has announced that he's a candidate for President of the United States in the next election in 2020. If elected, Yang, a Democrat, would become the first Asian American to hold that office. Yang told VOA Asia's Anna Cook that he would be unique in another way. He said his platform is centered on the idea of universal basic income, or a cash handout of $1,000 a month to everyone over age 18, irrespective of employment status.
So my flagship policy is the Freedom Dividend, where every American adult gets $1,000 a month free and clear starting at age 18. And this would enable millions of Americans to make better transitions, to move for new jobs, to seek genuine retraining, to be able to feed themselves and their families, and make the entire labor market much, much more dynamic than it is now.
Mm-hmm. And how would this be financed?
What America needs to do is it needs to join Europe and every other industrialized economy and have a value-added tax, which would then get the American people a slice of every Amazon transaction, every Google search, every robot truck mile. And because the American economy is now so vast at $20 trillion a year, up $5 trillion in the last 12 years alone, a value-added tax at even half the European level would generate $800 billion in new revenue, which combined with current spending, economic growth, cost savings, and value gains from the Freedom Dividend would be enough to pay for a dividend of $1,000 a month per adult.
The idea of value-added tax is not very familiar to Americans. How would you break that down, and how would it influence the everyday life of an average American?
Well, for the average American, they'd experience a value-added tax as something that they might pay a little bit extra on when they buy something. But keep in mind, in this case, we're taking all the money from consumption like that and putting it right back in the hands of the American people, so that the bottom 94% of Americans would have a net increase in purchasing power if they were getting $12,000 a year.
As the first Asian American possibly on the debate stage, and just not enough Asian Americans running for office, how has your experience been so far?
And that's something that I've personally found really rewarding and gratifying, because Asian Americans don't really see politics as something for us to lead in at a national level. And that's something that we can change. As a matter of fact, I'd say we must change it, because right now Asian Americans are something of an overlooked community politically, because we vote at lower levels, we donate at lower levels, and we run for office at lower levels. We also tend to be based in states that we cannot swing. We're based in New York, California, Texas, Massachusetts, which are clearly either blue or red. And so it's incumbent on us to really step up and participate more politically to show that we're just as American as anyone else, and that we can lead and contribute at the highest levels. And one of the reasons why I'm running for president is that my kids are growing up in this country, and I want to make this country stronger for them. And that goes for Asian Americans at every part of the community.
And do you see yourself as some sort of role model or figure that Asians can identify with to become more politically engaged?
Well, I really hope so. I mean, I hope seeing someone from their community run for president will get people's heads up and make them think bigger about what they can do in our national community. It's certainly a source of pride for me. And when I meet with Asian Americans and they tell me how excited they are for my campaign, it makes me really happy and proud.
And is the Asian American population something you're targeting?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I spend time with Asian American organizations when invited. I mean, Asian Americans are about 5.6% of the U.S. population, which is not a huge group, but in a very fragmented field, that's actually a very significant platform and jumping off point. So I spend a lot of time with Asian American communities. It's very natural, too, because I have many Asian American friends. My wife's Asian. So it would actually be very, very odd for me not to spend time with the community, because it's literally been the community I've been a part of my entire life.
We'll keep you updated on how Andrew Yang is doing on the campaign trail. He announced his candidacy for president in November 2017 and spoke with VOA Asia's Anna Cook. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. The role of Washington-Beijing ties on Northeast Asia. Australian political parties targeted in mass hacking attempt. Researcher says China's surveillance firm is tracking millions in Xinjiang. Dinosaur track saved from Australian floods. New York City's Chinatown welcomes Year of the Pig with vibrant parade. You'll find much more, pictures and videos too, when you go to VOA Asia Facebook and our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump is considering extending the March 1st deadline to impose higher tariffs on China as the world's two leading economies continue trade negotiations here in Washington. State Department correspondent Nike Ching has more.
Chinese President Xi Jinping met with top U.S. trade officials on Friday, following high-level negotiations aimed at striking a trade deal ahead of a March 1st deadline. Next week in Washington, negotiators will try to find agreement on Chinese policies that Washington says are anti-competitive, such as forced technology transfers. At the White House Rose Garden, U.S. President Donald Trump sounded positive.
It's going extremely well. Who knows what that means, because it only matters if we get it done, but we're very much working very closely with China and President Xi, who I respect a lot. Very good relationship that we have. And we're a lot closer than we ever were in this country with having a real trade deal.
But much work needs to be done. The U.S. demands a comprehensive change to Chinese practices that Washington considers unfair, including theft of intellectual property and numerous barriers to market access. China has offered to buy more U.S. goods, but is resisting calls for major changes to its industrial policies, such as slashing government subsidies. American lawmakers are voicing frustration.
But right now, it is very difficult. I mean, if you look at just look at the trade situation that we are in right now. I remember visiting with a number of U.S. businesses in China in 2015, and these businesses were saying, "Well, give President Xi a chance. Give these reforms a chance. We think things are going to work themselves out. There's a reform opportunity here." A year later, these same businesses were in my office saying, things have not changed. They're getting worse. The United States needs to act.
Washington worries China is stealing U.S. technology, some of which ends up with the Chinese military.
There's a sense that, you know, China was a partner to engage with. It was a country whose rise we wanted to shape. But when you got into conversations about what China was doing militarily, the way it was making defense and technology investments that could be challenging to the United States, there was a lot of that that was actually actively downplayed.
President Trump says he will meet with Xi after the talks next week. He may also extend the tariff deadline for 60 more days. But some critics are warning this may hurt America's credibility, leaving China to use a repeated tactic of buying more time amid trade disputes. Nike Ching, VOA News, State Department.
Happening now in Asia, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has refrained from commenting on whether he nominated U.S. President Donald Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize. Japan's Asahi newspaper reported Sunday that Abe nominated Trump last year after receiving a request from the U.S. government to do so. Stay up to date with VOA and VOA 60 You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. UN aid agencies are seeking $920 million to provide life-saving aid for more than 900,000 Rohingya refugees who fled violence and persecution in Myanmar and then crossed into Bangladesh. Aid money will also be used to assist more than 330,000 vulnerable Bangladeshis who are hosting them near the border in Cox's Bazar. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Most Rohingya refugees are living in cramped, squalid conditions in Kutupalong, the largest refugee camp in the world. Bangladeshi authorities have been praised for their generosity in hosting the large refugee population. But Bangladesh's State Minister of Foreign Affairs, Shahrar Alam, acknowledges the difficulties involved. Alam says the key to resolving the problem is repatriation. He says Bangladesh has been exploring this option with UN agencies. Last year, the UN and the government of Myanmar signed a memorandum of understanding regarding the repatriation of Rohingya refugees.
But unfortunately, the situation in Myanmar is still not conducive for a voluntary, safe, and dignified return. So we urge upon the international community to put pressure on Myanmar and engage with them constructively so as a responsible and responsive member of United Nations, they take their citizens back without further delays.
In the meantime, he says action must be taken to support and protect the refugees. Alam says his government has spent about $250 million to get one of the nearby islands ready to relocate and shelter up to 100,000 Rohingya.
Because the place where they're staying is vulnerable to heavy rain and cyclone. And this is one of the biggest worries that we had from 2018. We are soon approaching the monsoon and the cyclone season, and I hope that will be enough for this year for a safe stay of the Rohingya people.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, says in the coming weeks, work must be accelerated to protect the Rohingya from the ravages of the next monsoon season. Grandi says he is optimistic the money to fund the operation will be forthcoming. He adds several countries attending a donors' conference have pledged $132 million, and several other major donors said they would announce pledges in the coming weeks.
So I think this figure will quickly rise, and I think, you know, for this type of exercise, having a result immediately like that is not bad. Is a sign, I hope, of continued support for a situation that unfortunately gets protracted.
The UN says more than half of the funding will go for food, water, sanitation, and shelter. Other key sectors of the appeal include health, site management, and protection for children and survivors of sexual and gender-based violence. The Director General of the International Organization for Migration, Antonio Vitorino, says addressing the critical needs of the Rohingya refugees is the biggest challenge. At the same time, he says the impact of the refugees on the host communities in Bangladesh must be addressed.
The two things go together, that at the same time we address the needs of those who are displaced, but we minimize the impacts that those massive displacement of people has in the host communities.
Competition for resources and jobs has raised tensions between the Rohingya and host communities. UN agencies have succeeded in lessening environmental degradation, reducing the prevalence of acute malnutrition, increasing child immunizations, and other benefits. They note the situation of the Rohingya remains precarious until the root causes of displacement in Myanmar are addressed and the refugees can go home. They say international support will remain crucial. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up, rare fossils are saved from destruction. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
RadioPrograms.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. China's foreign ministry says criticism of tech giant Huawei made by U.S. Vice President Mike Pence at the Munich Security Conference was wrong and partial. Pence urged allies to avoid Chinese telecom gear companies, saying Chinese law requires them to give Beijing access to networks and data. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, a team of Australian paleontologists and volunteers has saved a once-in-a-lifetime fossil discovery from devastating floods in Queensland state. Leaving us his lasting impressions is Phil Mercer from Sydney.
The dinosaur tracks give a rare insight into an ancient world. Found on an outback farm near the Queensland town of Winton, 1,100 kilometres from Brisbane, they're estimated to be almost 100 million years old. The footprints are stamped into a large slab of sandstone rock and were made by a sauropod, a giant creature with a long neck and tail, and by two smaller dinosaurs. Some of the footprints are up to a metre wide and come from the Cretaceous period. Scientists were alerted to the danger posed to this remarkable collection when it was partly damaged by severe flooding last year. For 3 weeks, scientists and volunteers worked to carefully dig up and relocate the dinosaur tracks. They're being stored at the Australian Age of Dinosaurs Museum in Winton, where they will eventually go on display. David Elliott is the museum's executive chairman.
We really want to preserve the integrity of the tracks. We don't want to just tear them up and go and plonk them on the ground somewhere. You know, they have to be done a certain way. We can't just leave it here because that's, you know, find of a lifetime.
Dinosaur tracks are rare in Australia. Steve Porripat, a paleontologist at Swinburne University in Melbourne, says the footprints were saved from recent monsoonal flooding in Queensland.
The imperative was to get those soft footprints out of the ground because they just wouldn't have lasted in another flood now that they've been fully exposed. To get it all out of the ground to make sure that it's safe from future floods is fantastic.
Monsoonal rains in Queensland have caused chaos, flooding hundreds of homes and drowning several hundred thousand livestock. Officials said it was a one-in-a-100-year event, and they've warned it could take years to rebuild the local cattle industry. As the floodwaters recede on land, they're polluting parts of the Great Barrier Reef. Experts say plumes of polluted water are stretching up to 60 kilometres from the coast, putting more pressure on coral that suffered mass bleaching in recent years. When ocean temperatures increase, corals can expel the algae that live in their tissues, causing the coral to turn completely white. The Great Barrier Reef is Australia's greatest natural treasure and stretches 2,300 kilometres down Australia's northeast coastline. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news from VOA Asia. In Beijing, lantern shows illuminated the night sky to welcome the Lantern Festival, celebrated on the 15th day of the first month in the Chinese lunar calendar. That's today, for many of us, February 19th on the Western or Gregorian calendar. All the big stories come your way through the day, every day of the year, on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, insects are the most biodiverse group of living things on the planet. And it's a good thing there's so many of them, because they're responsible for many of the fundamental processes that allow life on Earth, from pollination to decomposition. But as VOA's Kevin Enix reports, a new report suggests they are disappearing, and that could be catastrophic.
A growing number of the Earth's insect population now exists only in collections like these.
Nobody's seen those for 100 years.
A new review of over 70 studies of insect populations suggests that human pressures are causing insect populations to plummet by as much as a quarter every decade.
Some of my colleagues have compared it to playing Jenga. You know, you remove pieces from the Jenga tower and everything seems to be okay. And then you remove one piece and the whole thing falls down. And you don't know which piece in advance that's going to be. And once you've removed it, you can't put it back again. So the loss of species is inevitably concerning because often we don't know what those species are doing. We don't know what other species are depending on them.
Insects make up the largest class of animals on Earth and represent more than half of all known living organisms. They are incredibly diverse and in many ways make life on Earth possible. Bees and butterflies pollinate our food, flowers, and trees. They feed all kinds of larger animals, including humans, and insects play a vital role in the decomposition of all kinds of organic matter, from leaves to roadkill. Their collapse is being driven by human activity, everything from traffic to industrial farming and pesticides to light pollution. Scientists say doing nothing to solve the problem is not an option.
A large number of the crops we eat and rely on are pollinated by insects. So imagine a world where that pollination process is not taking place. And there are some cases already around the world where we are having to pollinate by hand at huge cost, at huge economic cost, simply because the insects aren't there to do the work that we would normally ask them to do for free. And in some cases, if you're talking about food crops, just try and imagine the scale of what that would look like if insects weren't doing that for us.
One big caveat, all of the studies come from industrialized countries in Europe and North America. The researchers say they simply don't have the data to census the robust insect species in more tropical regions. But in these industrialized countries, the report predicts that all insect species could be gone in a century. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Billed as the largest and longest-running auto show in North America, there's a notable change at this year's Chicago Auto Show in the kinds of vehicles on display at the city's McCormick Place Convention Center. As VOA's Kane Faribault reports from Chicago, the shifting preferences of consumers is driving the kinds of vehicles manufacturers are producing and marketing.
On our commitment to passenger cars.
A special preview for members of the media at the annual Chicago Auto Show is a chance for manufacturers to show off their latest and greatest products about to enter the market. But what is notable about this year's show is what some manufacturers aren't showing off, new sedans.
So over 10 years now, there's been a consistent movement of customers in the United States and around the world, but even more so in the United States, moving away from sedans, more traditional passenger sedans, into more utility vehicles.
Joe Hinrichs is president of Ford Motor Company's global operations.
They like the ride height, seating height, the utility of the vehicle, and now we can give them the fuel efficiency they used to get in sedans. So that's where customers are going. Nearly 7 out of 10 vehicles sold today are trucks or SUVs in the U.S. market, and we'll continue to go where the market's going, where the customers are.
But while Ford is giving new options for consumers, it is also taking away models of the Focus, Fiesta, and Fusion cars, ending production later this year.
Well, we've been planning our business to incorporate the expectation that some of those cars would go away and then bring in new products to the market.
We have the debate a lot about, is a compact SUV the new family sedan? And in many instances, you could say yes.
The prominence and choices of SUVs, crossovers, and trucks in General Motors' current lineup stands in contrast to its perennial auto show attraction in recent years, the Chevrolet Volt. The Volt was the top-selling electric plug-in vehicle of all time. But recent sagging sales have led GM to cease production of the Volt in March.
Volt was a great product for us, had a great run, two generations, but what has happened is, as the ability to produce pure electric in the kind of cost, configuration, and range what people are looking for, Volt had its time, but was a great stepping stone for us to lead to the future, which is pure electrification.
Chevrolet does plan to keep making a similar sounding car, the Bolt, an all-electric vehicle, and the midsize sedan Malibu, among a few other options.
So we're not abandoning the car market completely. We're right-sizing our portfolio. We're reacting to what the consumers are looking for.
What they are looking for are trucks and SUVs, which made up about 70% of the 17 million vehicles sold in the U.S. in 2018, a trend expected to continue this year. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at voanews.com, on Facebook at VOA Asia, also on iTunes and SoundCloud. You'll find us on the radio at Chiang Mai University, Radio FM 100 at Chiang Mai University in Thailand. We thank everyone there who's tuned into our program today, as we thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Aydin Utku, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day.